Yeah. Well, good morning to everyone. So let me just start thanking the organizers for the invitation. It's of course a pleasure to be here. It was actually some time since I came to KITP, maybe it was 5 years ago. So I'm glad to be back. So I'm going to be talking about quantum thermodynamics of complex systems, and the talk is actually divided in two parts. One will resonate with the talk you will hear on Thursday by Roberto Serra. So it's about the realization of thermal machines with no friction. So the idea that you can get high efficiency and high power even if you run a machine in finite time. And the second part is about work statistics for complex systems. Yes, so I will mention more about it. So let me start with the first part. The idea is how to realize a heat engine which runs with no friction. And I'm going to report progress on cold atoms. And as I mentioned, there will be more results in this conference in an NMR setting. So the motivation, one of the motivations to study heat engines maybe comes from possible connections with energy science. So at certain level of abstraction, you can think of light harvesting both in solar cells as well as in nature as a thermodynamic cycle, which is essentially running realizing a quantum heat engine. So this is a set of ideas which was put forward by Marlon Scully and Samuel Mukamel and also colleagues at Ulm. And the idea is, of course, if we learn to operate heat engines very efficiently and, you know, at least naively, you may hope to transfer some of this knowledge to artificial cells, solar cells. So the setting I'm going to consider is Otto cycle. So this is a simplified setting because it consists of four strokes in which the dynamics is either isolated. So for instance, you have a working substance which is confined in a trap at cold temperature, and you can compress it easily, and this stroke is unitary. You do work on the system. Then the system is coupled to a hot reservoir, so it essentially thermalizes at to high temperature, to an equilibrium state. And once it's hot, it can do some work on the outside by making an expansion in which, in this case, a parameter of the Hamiltonian, say the frequency of the trap, will change. So this is an expansion stroke. And this is also unitary, yeah? So no cap into the heat reservoir there. Finally, you close the cycle by cooling this non-equilibrium state by coupling it to a cold reservoir, and then you go back to the beginning. Mm. So this is in a many particle setting, and let's see. So when you have a, you know, one of the possible ways of characterizing the performance of this cycle is just by looking at the efficiency. So the amount of work done by the cycle as over the heat that it is absorbed, the heat taken from the hot reservoir. And the other possibility is to look at the power, which is the amount of work done per unit of time. So this is a very standard way of characterizing the performance of a heat engine, pretty much as you will do at the macro scale. And the kind of working substance I'm going to consider is essentially a quantum fluid. So a bunch of particles with equal mass, both all of them in the same kind of trap, and the parameter that is going to be changing in the Hamiltonian is the frequency of the trap. And the kind of interactions between the different particles of the working medium is going to be very general, but I'm going to impose this condition, which is that the potential, the interaction potential, is a homogeneous function of degree minus two, and the reason to do that is because the movie that you are seeing here, this is the density profile of the cloud. Whenever you have these kind of interactions, the dynamics gets very much simplified. So essentially, it is a scale invariant. So this is what you are seeing. So the density profile just preserves its shape, and the only thing that it does is to change the by a scaling factor as the frequency of the trap here in blue gets either compressed or expanded. Yeah? So this is going to be the kind of working substance to realize this Otto cycle. And yes, a bit technically, one of the motivations also to be able to assess the thermodynamics of the cycle is that the mean energy, even away from equilibrium, can be computed very efficiently if you have this kind of scale invariant dynamics. In particular, it can always be related to the initial energy of the system. the initial squeezing and the initial particle fluctuations. So at equilibrium, initial squeezing typically goes to zero, and you can combine these two terms to just get the mean energy. Yeah? The coefficients here in all these terms are set by this function, B, and this is just essentially the radius of the cloud. It's telling you whether the cloud is expanding, so then B will be larger than one, or it's compressing. Yeah? So this is the scaling factor, and as you see, it is completely determined by the frequency of the trap. So you solve this simple differential equation. You see the huge complexity reduction from solving the many-body Schrödinger equation for this system, which will be extremely challenging. In the presence of a scaling variants, we have reduced it to solving a classical equation. Yeah? And this is what is going to allow us to describe the thermodynamics exactly.
So what are the requirements that the scaling variants hold?
So here at this level, it's that the when you multiply the coordinates by a given constant, you can pull out this constant by out of the potential. So, for instance, a two-dimensional Bose-Einstein condensate will satisfy this property because contact interactions in two dimensions have this Pitayevsky-Rho symmetry, and that will be a case, yes. So in this talk, we will look at a different system which also satisfies this property. It's not, of course, general, but there are important instances where it is satisfied. Now, the importance of knowing the mean energy is that essentially we can estimate something which is going to be quantum friction. So this is just the ratio between the non-adiabatic energy and the energy under the slow driving. So you see just the ratio between the two is what is called the non-adiabatic factor. And this happens to limit the performance of the heat engine. So this is going to play a crucial role. And so we will think of this as friction, and it turns out that we also understand it very well. It's just essentially given, again, in terms of the evolution of the scaling factor. Good. So here is when we see that actually this Q, so these non-adiabatic excitations, limit the performance of the heat engine. So this is, in these processes, the dynamics is unitary, so work is just difference in energy of the final state minus the initial state, and we can compute efficiently, or exactly, actually, what's the efficiency of the cycle. And we see, well, that is given by this expression in terms of the energies of these states at its points of the cycle. And here is the important thing. The efficiency of the engine run in finite time is always upper bounded by this expression, which is kind of a non-adiabatic auto-efficiency, where you see that the Q star, which is the non-adiabatic excitations in the expansion stroke, limit the performance of the engine. So you want to have this Q star equal to 1, such that the efficiency takes the maximum value, which will be the auto efficiency. Now, the idea is how to do this in the laboratory, and where we can engineer efficiency, a thermodynamic cycle which has no friction, such that the efficiency is maximum, yeah, even when we go fast. So this is more or less the focus. We want to speed up the cycle and manage to control excitations such that the efficiency takes the maximum value. Well, so the idea is to make use of shortcuts to adiabaticity. So maybe some of you have heard, these are a set of control tools which allow you to guide the dynamics of a quantum system in such a way that the final state is exactly the same state that you will get under slow driving in the adiabatic limit. Yeah? So you can, it's a way of avoiding the adiabatic theorem. You pump lots of excitations into the system, but you manage to remove them upon completion of the process such that you prepare actually the same state that you will get under slow driving. And this set of techniques have by now been implemented in a number of processes such as expansion, compressions, adiabatic passages, and including critical phenomena. Actually, Jörg Smith-Meyer in the first row is one of the persons who did one of the key experiments with coal atoms demonstrating the implementation of these shortcuts. So the applications in this talk are going to be focused on quantum thermodynamics, but let me just mention that these ideas can be applied as well in other quantum platforms and other techniques or other fields, such as ion transport or loading coal atoms in an optical lattice in the ground state, probing quantum correlations in quantum fluids, or just suppressing topological defects in classical phase transitions, or even in quantum phase transitions. And there we are recently exploring connections with quantum annealing. But today we focus on quantum thermal. And the idea is, let me just mention as well that this body of literature on this topic is growing quite a lot. And recently we decided to edit a focus issue in New Journal of Physics together with Ki-Wan Kim, who is an experimentalist at Tsinghua University. So in this issue, you can catch up with the latest developments on the topic of shortcuts. Yes. Here, with respect to the Otto cycle, what we want to do is we know where the quantum friction is coming from. It's coming from the fast expansion. So we want to do a fast superadiabatic expansion, fast superadiabatic compression. And in such a way, we will run the cycle quickly with no friction. So the idea is essentially to replace these two strokes by making use of shortcuts to adiabaticity. And this is something which was first proposed with John Gould, which may be somewhere in the audience over there, and Mauro Paternostro in 2014. This was in a very simple setting, just for essentially a harmonic oscillator. At the same time, Peter Hange and Yan Bingong were working on these ideas, and they did it in classical systems. And more recently, we suggested that this could be done in this setting, which is a many-body quantum heat engine, yes, whenever the working substance contains lots of particles. And so this was, so far, these were essentially theoretical ideas, which were proposed in the last few years. And recently, in a collaboration with Haibin Bu from East China Normal University, we were able to report some of this to actually implement it in the laboratory. So the idea is we have not been able to realize a full cycle. So I think maybe we'll hear about it from Roberto Serra in a different system. But here, with a unitary Fermi gas, we were able to show that you can suppress friction in finite time when you go arbitrarily fast. So the experiment, you know, is an ultra cold atom setup where, you know, essentially there's going to be a working substance that you can see here, fluorescein, which is an ultra cold atomic Fermi gas, which is, you know, you impinge a laser and you get the signal from the fluorescein. And you can image with a CCD camera, so you can record the time evolution during the compression and expansion. And of course, you require lots of laser controls to be able to tune this harmonic trap with high accuracy. And so abstracting a bit the experimental setup, what we have is two laser beams, which are orthogonal. And these are the ones which realize the three-dimensional harmonic trap. And the frequency of its, you know, the power laser can be tuned independently so as to control the confinement of the ultra-cold atomic cloud very efficiently with high accuracy. The experiment typically first prepares a Fermi gas, which is a superfluid, but at some point one can engineer this shortcut to a adiabatic expansion or a compression. And then after that, the ultra-cold cloud is probed using time of flight to see whether it's at equilibrium or there's quantum friction or what was the final state. So theoretically, the way one can think about this system is essentially made of lithium atoms, lithium 6. This is a fermion. And choosing two hyperfine states, essentially you can show that they play the role of the spin. And we have, again, very similar to the previous Hamiltonian, but here in second quantization, we have particles of equal mass in the same trap. And they talk to each other whenever the spin configurations are different. Yeah, so spin up, spin down can interact. If they have the same spin, there's Pauli blocking, so this term will be zero. But the important thing is that in the laboratory, the interaction coupling strength here, G, can be tuned simply with a magnetic field. So it can be set either to zero or to effectively infinity. Yes. By changing a magnetic field in the setup. Yeah? So this is the so-called Fesbach resonance technique, and you can change the magnetic field to realize an ideal spin 1/2 Fermi gas, or ramp the interactions to infinity to realize what is called a unitary Fermi gas, which is strongly coupled, because this term is huge. Yeah, it has a huge coupling strength. Now, both of these two limits are nice because they satisfy this property. So this goes back to the question by George, when you have this. So clearly, if B is zero, there are no interactions. So then you have just this part, and this is like independent harmonic oscillators. But if G is also infinity, then the system is described by a conformal symmetry, and then scale invariance appears there because effectively you satisfy this property. And then you have this kind of dynamics where the scaling, where the density profile just evolves according to a scaling factor. Now, how to realize shortcuts in these kind of systems? It is actually very, very simple. The idea is we want to either expand the cloud or compress it, and the control parameter here is the frequency of the trap. And we want to do something like a fast motion video of the adiabatic dynamics. So you can picture expanding the cloud very slowly and compressing it very slowly, and then whether it's possible to find a control protocol that drives the dynamics very fast, exactly through the same evolution, through the same trajectory. And this is what shortcuts to adiabaticity manage to do. So they you prescribe an evolution of the system, which you will achieve under a slow driving, and then you can speed it up and exactly run a fast motion video of this trajectory. In this context, you fix a adiabatic evolution with some reference frequency. It suffices to implement in the laboratory a different frequency, which takes into account the rate of change and the acceleration of your reference trajectory. So if you are able to implement this in the laboratory, then the atomic cloud will pretty much follow this shortcut to adiabaticity with a fast motion video, or speeding up very quickly. Now, so let me show you what we can study in the laboratory. So this is, if you don't do a shortcut to adiabaticity and you just implement your reference trajectory, so you just choose an arbitrary frequency modulation, what you see is that the radius of the cloud starts to grow in an expansion, and then instead of reaching equilibrium value, it keeps oscillating, and that reflects that you have excited the breathing mode of the cloud, so there's excitations that we will be able to associate with quantum friction. And the different curves are, one is for the ideal Fermi gas in blue, the other one is for the unitary Fermi gas, so it shows that the excitations depend on the interactions in the system. So this is what happens if you just do a simple expansion with no control, but you can alternatively use the shortcuts to adiabaticity, and here you see a very different evolution where the radius of the cloud increases and then reaches equilibrium, and up to noise, it stays pretty much constant. Yeah? And this works both for in the non-interacting regime as well as at unitarity, so it's, in these two regimes we can implement these shortcuts to adiabaticity. Now, so that was just by looking at the radius of the cloud, but from the sequence of time of flight images, we can also we can take pictures of the atomic cloud at different times of the process, and then with that information, we can essentially estimate the mean energy of the cloud, of the expanding cloud, and in that way, we can reconstruct the quantum friction coefficient. And this can be done along the shortcut, along the expansion. And this is the comparison between a standard expansion where friction is you start in an equilibrium state and you drive the system and the mean energy is non-adiabatic so that it accumulates some quantum friction. Now, so this is for a regular expansion. But now you can implement a shortcut to adiabaticity, and this is what you see. You pump energy into the system. It goes through some crazy transients where there's lots of excitations. But what is important is that at the end of the process, the system has reached equilibrium. There is no residual excitations. So you have drive the system very fast, but at the end, there is no excitation. So in a way, friction is zero. Yeah? So we can also look at the work output in a expansion stroke, and what you see, again, we compare the work output from the reference trajectory, which takes some given value at the finite time, And we can look here at the shortcut to adiabaticity. What you see is that there are some transient fluctuations in the work output, but you just care about the end of the process, then the work output is actually larger than with the reference trajectory. Yeah. So this in a way, by suppressing friction, we maximize the work output, so you get the best possible result. Now, yes, as a way of characterizing maybe the cost of the shortcut, we can look at the difference between the mean work and the adiabatic work. So in the previous talk, Eric Lutz was mentioning this intuition that the faster we drive the system, you know, the more friction we have. This is true as long as we, you know, if the system is isolated, but we can use shortcuts to prevent this. Yes. So here is a demonstration where, you know, the system being completely isolated, we can drive it very fast. We can pump lots of energy into the system, but actually there will be no you know, essentially we can reduce the dissipation, yeah, by setting the friction to zero. The quantity we can measure is essentially the excess of work over the adiabatic work. And by just looking at the time integral of this process, we can essentially get kind of a work time uncertainty relation. And you see in that here, it matches well this power law. So this is the how the excess of work increases with the time of the stroke. So if the stroke is very fast, then the excess of work time integrated will be very large. Yes. So this is essentially gives you a bit of an idea of the cost of implementing these shortcuts to adiabaticity. So these are different plots. One is for the unitary, and the other one for the Fermi gas at unitarity, and the other one for the ideal Fermi gas. So this is for the no, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So essentially, with this, you know, this demonstrates that we can do speed up these expansions and compressions. We have done both. I have just shown the expansions, but in such a way, we in principle we can realize this heat engine, which will have no friction, and for that engine, you indeed have this property that the efficiency acquires the maximum value, reaches the maximum value, and here, you know, in this case, it's an auto cycle, so you have the auto efficiency. Yeah. This has been extended also to all other settings and even to refrigerators, not just engines, by Obina, who is in the audience, and Eric. Yeah. So what we have done here is only the expansion and the compression stroke. Let me just mention that, of course, we would like to realize the full cycle. And you can anticipate a set of challenges that will appear. First, you know, the idea is how to do the heating and the cooling strokes. This is what we are missing in this setting. And heating may be easy. You can just do some parametric heating by shaking the harmonic trap or even the interaction strength. What will be difficult in this setting is to cool the cloud to without losing atoms, yes? Because the typical techniques to cool ultra-cold gases include or involve evaporation, as this one of the ones that was mentioned in the previous talk. So you evaporate you essentially run the cycle, but eventually you run out of working substance. So this is not really the best strategy. So if you have any ideas as to how to do that, of course they are welcome. Maybe one could think of bringing a cold reservoir, a different atomic cloud, to put it in contact, but this is maybe very challenging in the lab. Now, a very different kind of difficulty that we found is that during this hot stroke, depending on the temperature, the system stops being a superfluid and actually starts to behave as a viscous fluid. And this also challenges the implementation of shortcuts. So it may be more difficult to do these super adiabatic strokes, and actually there may be some limits. Yeah? So this is something we hope to report pretty soon in this focus issue on shortcuts. So this is the progress with cold atoms, and as I mentioned, I think the progress in NMR has gone farther because they effectively realized the full cycle, as far as I understand, and we will hear about it on Thursday. Right, so this was the first part of the talk. Now I want to essentially move to something completely different. It's which is work statistics in complex systems. So in this first part, we were only able essentially to measure mean energy, and with mean energy we were able to say something about mean work, but we do not have access really to work fluctuations. So this is, now is going to be essentially theory work where we focus on work statistics. And the notion of work is going to be that of an isolated system which has some Hamiltonian, and here the time is, I just call it S, is the time of evolution, and I'm going to focus on unitary processes, so the system will be isolated, and the definition of work I'm going to use is just the two projective measurement scheme, where you do an energy measurement at the beginning of the process to measure what's the probability of occupying a given mode at time zero. Then you run the process through some unitary time evolution, and at the end of the process you do a second energy projective measurement to address the transition probabilities. And then work is just the difference between the eigenvalues for any such trajectory, will be just the difference between the energy eigenstate of the final state and the initial state. Yeah. Now, if you want to apply this recipe to complex systems, well, the Hilbert space grows exponentially with the system size, and the number of transitions is also going to grow. So this is maybe not the best way of looking at the work statistics of complex systems. So let's see what we can do in this case. And one of the things that is going to prove convenient is to look at the work moment generating function. So this is just the Fourier transform of the work statistics, of the work probability distribution. And now I introduce a variable which I call it T, so it should suggest that acquires an interpretation of time, of some kind of time, but let me emphasize that this time has nothing to do with the time of evolution in which we drive, we do work. Yeah? We have a system, we evolve it in time S, and we change the Hamiltonian, and we are looking at the work statistics associated with that. At this stage, T is just the variable which is conjugated to work in Fourier analysis. Now, you can write this explicitly in terms of the eigenstates of the system, and the characteristic function takes this form, which is actually very nice. It's kind of an average, maybe thermal average, if these are Boltzmann factors, of a Losmi Fekko amplitude, where you start in an initial state, you evolve it in this fictitious time, so it's the variable conjugated to work, you evolve it with a constant Hamiltonian, which is the initial one, and then you go backwards in time with a different Hamiltonian, which is the final one in the quench, conjugated with the time evolution operator, which describes the whole dynamics. So this is, for the case of time-dependent Hamiltonians, they don't have to commute. Yeah. So this already suggests that there may be a connection between the characteristic function and Losmi-Fekko amplitudes. So you may be familiar with the work that Alessandro Silva did in 2008, where he actually explicitly proposed this interpretation. So he focused on the case of in which the system is prepared in an eigenstate of the initial Hamiltonian. So it's not a mixed state, it's just a pure state, which is the whole system is initialized in an eigenstate. And then the kind of evolution is restricted to a sudden quench. So essentially this unitary, the unitary commutes with the final Hamiltonian, so this is just essentially h of t, the final one. And in that case, the characteristic function really takes a very simple form, which is the initial state, forward time evolution with the initial Hamiltonian, backward time evolution with the final one, and then you project on the final state. Yeah. So this is nice because in a way, by casting the characteristic function in terms of a Losmi Fekko, then you map work statistics to a dynamical problem, and you avoid the computation of all these transition probabilities explicitly. Yeah? Of course, the dynamics still accounts for this, but you don't have to deal with them explicitly. So we want to generalize this to arbitrary setting. So early work by Silva, there were these two restrictions. One is on the purity of the initial eigenstate, which should be an energy eigenstate, and also the kind of evolution should be a sudden quench. So what we propose is, just look at the take an arbitrary initial state and then just purify it. Yeah? So double the Hilbert space, consider two copies of the system, and then look at this entangled state where these are essentially just the square root of the Boltzmann factors. And well, then you can still rewrite the characteristic function, but now as a loss, as a survival amplitude of this state when it's propagated in time in this form. So one of the copies does not evolve. So this, you, for instance, do nothing to the right copy. And the left copy evolves in the same way, so forward in time with its own Hamiltonian and backward in time with the reverse Hamiltonian. Yeah? So in a way, this allows you to, for an arbitrary process, you can think of the work statistics as a survival amplitude of an entangled state, yeah? In which one of the copies does not evolve and the other one goes through a Loss-Smith echo. Now, of course, then the Loss-Smith echo is just related to the work statistics by a Fourier transform. So we can, if you have access to this probability amplitude, you know the work statistics. Or conversely, if you know the work statistics, you can retrieve information about the fate of this entangled state during this kind of evolution. Right. So by establishing this connection between work statistics and Loss-Smith echoes, we can also establish a connection between work statistics and information scrambling. So this was something which was already mentioned in the first talk by Irfan. And one of the ways of assessing information scrambling was proposed by Papadodimas and Rayou, who essentially say it's precisely this survival amplitude of entangled state and its time evolution which captures how the correlations are spread out among different degrees of freedom. And it turns out, well, that if you take this proposal and you just identify the time of evolution with this Loss-Smith echo, then you are showing that essentially work statistics does know about information scrambling in this sense. Yes. So that there are other works which have also unveiled connections between work statistics and information scrambling, but this was focused on out-of-time order correlators, which were presented before. So that was by John Gould and Campisi and Nicole, who is also in the audience. But we are mainly focused on this survival probability of an entangled state. And we have just a few minutes, so let me just mention that the kind of systems we look at were chaotic systems, which are a paradigm of complex systems, but also are used to assess information scrambling. Yeah? And there, one can consider an ensemble of matrices of Hamiltonians, which are described by random matrix theory. And depending on the symmetries of the problem, there one considers different ensembles, which can be either just Hermitian matrices or real symmetric if they have time reversal symmetry. So let me just present the results. So we consider as an initial state the purification of a thermal state. So it's just you take a density matrix which is thermal, you double the Hilbert space, and this is the entangled state that describes this purification, is the so-called thermophile double state. And then we consider just a change of a Hamiltonian from initial value to a different random matrix Hamiltonian. So now this is chaotic and this is chaotic, but they are different Hamiltonians. And then what you see is that the Loss-Smith echo has an evolution in time, which is the typical one which is observed in information scrambling. There's a fast decay, then there's a dip, and then eventually there's a revival until it reaches a plateau. And the features of this plot are actually dictated by work statistics. In particular, the early short time decay is governed by the work fluctuations, and the long time decay is essentially the purity of the initial state. So here you see very explicitly this connection between work statistics and the Loss-Smith echo dynamics, which you know essentially captures all this part of the plot and also the plateau. Yeah, so we have two more. Okay, very good. So here's the last slide. We also consider what's the work to reverse the dynamics. So essentially it's the work that a Maxwell daemon will have to do. So you have a system and you wonder, you know, how much work it takes to reverse the dynamics. So we consider Hamiltonians would have time reversal symmetry, and then implementing the time reversal operation also it just boils down to switch the sign of the initial Hamiltonian to minus its value. Yeah, so the final Hamiltonian is minus the initial one. And in this case, you see very clearly that the Loschmidt echo is given by the survival probability of the thermofield double state, but this is nothing but the analytic continuation of the partition function, which is precisely the kind of object that has been used to assess information scrambling and is also known in the literature of quantum chaos to characterize the spectral properties. Now, the work statistics is fully given by the density of states, and you can also get from there, of course, all moments, including the mean work. But again, you know, so the point is that knowledge of the work statistics gives you the Loschmidt echo, and conversely. So, yeah, so essentially, this I close now with this. We have seen that there's the possibility of realizing quantum machines which have no friction, and this is possible using shortcuts to adiabaticity, which we implemented with ideal and unitary Fermi gases. And this allows for the control of friction and its measurement as well. Yeah. And in the second part of the talk, we have kind of established a general connection between work statistics and Loschmidt echoes. And through that connection, we can also relate work statistics to scrambling, and which we have presented, you know, in both for chaotic systems and for time reversal. So with this, I just want to thank my collaborators, in particular my group at UMass and the Haibing Wu group, which has done the experiments, and you know, Aurelia Sinu in the theory group, who's a close collaborator. So I thank you all for your attention.
Thank you. Questions? Yep.
In this idea that in shortcuts to adiabaticity, you inject a bunch of excitations and then take them out, if your system is also connected to like a very weak reservoir, that should have a dramatic effect, you know, because then the friction should be very high.
Yeah, have so you this considered is, this that? Is something you may have discussed with Ronnie Kozlov. I mean, so different people have tried to quantify the cost of doing shortcuts to adiabaticity, and you can do it from an energetic point of view. So certainly you need to increase energy fluctuations so that you can go faster. We have looked with Masahito Ueda at the work fluctuations in the process, and also from a practical point of view, the system is not unitary, but then you are changing the rules of the game, then it can decohere, and this can be a perturbation, yes? But for cold atoms, there have been by now lots of experiments where this is not an issue, yeah? Because the system is very well isolated. And shortcuts have also been implemented in NB centers, trapped ions, and so on. So it can be an issue, but yeah, not necessarily.
But you can get more work out of
you by doing shortcuts, you reduce all friction and you get the maximum work output. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the same applies for a refrigeration cycle.
So this is something that Eric Lutz and Obina Abba have discussed. Yes, but yeah, in principle, if you have something like an auto cycle which is running reverse, so you have a refrigerator, mm-hmm. then you can also set the friction to zero and you get maximum cooling power. Yeah.
Okay, there are two questions, maybe. Ivan?
Maybe a naive question. So as you found the relation between this RMT, random matrices, and this Loschmidt-like echo, the Fourier transform of their probability distribution of work, maybe you can say something about the oscillations of this Loschmidt echo and this so-called correlation hole, the deep below this finite structure. So is it
yes.
related, what to which it's related? Because in random matrices, it's related to the density of states, to the age of the density of state, and so on, and ergodicity. So another question related to this, maybe, so you consider random matrix theory, which is ergodic or chaotic. What will happen if you consider multifractal system or even integrable system instead? Thank you.
Right. Yeah, so maybe, yes, I can quickly mention that in this case, you see, for instance, that the work statistics is just dictated by the Fourier transform by the density of states, and maybe let me look for an equation. Yeah, here you have it. So this is for a single trajectory. Given the work statistics, you Fourier transform it, you get the Loschmidt echo. Now, if you have an ensemble, you have to realize whether you want to look at the ensemble of Los Mith echoes or the ensemble of worker statistics. Yes. So if you take the average of the Los Mith echo, then you have to unravel what's the ensemble of this integral. And this knows about the correlation hole. It knows not just about the density of states. It has, you require information about the correlation between different energy levels. And so this essentially, you require the spectral form factor, and that's what has all the knowledge about how energy levels are correlated. And so this is explicitly what we use, yes? And the issue now, however, is that because we are changing between two different Hamiltonians, the structure of this part is not so simple as in the usual studies such as information scrambling, where people just only consider one single Hamiltonian, and then this is much better understood. Yeah? So then these peaks are really connected with correlation hole and so on, which is the same that in early studies of on quantum chaos, people like Rafa Levin and so on consider the Fourier transform of the spectral form factor. But this is just because the final Hamiltonian is related to the initial one. Otherwise, in an arbitrary quench, I will do not have such one-to-one, you know, kind of understanding. Yes. And for integral systems, we haven't looked at it. The issue is that this kind of state has an actual interpretation in the context of black holes, which were mentioned in Irfan's talk. So quantum chaos is used for information scrambling also as a test bed. So that's why we focus on random matrix Hamiltonians.
John? Adolfo, just a curiosity related to the first question. So, I mean, is there any work been done in the direction of, rather than engineering a unitary process to be adiabatic, maybe you could engineer an open system process to be isothermal?
Yes, So this is kind of, as a general question, how to assist the dynamics of open systems and speed it up. It's an open issue in the literature of shortcuts to adiabaticity. I think the early first kind of nice work was given by Massimo Palma, Blanco Vedral, maybe Mauro Paternostro was also called for. So it's a new journal of physics. It typically is much more complicated, yeah? I think Sebastian Derner has also been working, you know, you just want to be closely, you know, it's slow driving, it's not quite an arbitrary fast speed of evolution. You just want to speed it a bit, then there are also some techniques which are approximate in the spirit of linear response theory. But
nothing
how to speed up an arbitrary open process is, as far as I know, it's open. Yeah.
Okay. We still have maybe time for one or two questions. Oh, yeah, Michele.
So regarding the last point that John raised, in the, thinking about the efficiency of engines, you don't really want to have your system following closely the isotherm. You rather want to exchange heat fastly. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's not really relevant in the context of heat engine. So this is more like a comment than a question, but.
Yes, no, I will agree with that, yeah? So I haven't, you know, in the first part of the talk, let me just mention, we assume that we have perfect isothermals where the system reaches, you know, whichever non-equilibrium state you have here, you couple it to a bath and, you know, it thermalizes. And I didn't describe that step. I focus on the unitary dynamics. Ronnie Kozlov has done works where, you know, for given master equations, you see how friction can also emerge in the heating and cooling processes. Of course, if you are able to speed up, you know, heat flow, that will help. But again, I do not know of any general way of doing that. I think people are trying, but it's generally a hard problem. Even just, certainly if you come with the intuition of using adiabatic notions, then it's maybe not the way to do it. Yeah. So I mean, there's Marcelo Serandi and different people have, Daniel Lidar have this notion of adiabatic theory for open systems, but then, and I think that was the point of the work by Massimo Palma. They took this idea and tried to use techniques of shortcuts to speed up the dynamics, but then what you get is not it's not really what you want in general.
Okay, I think we will move on. So let's thank Adolfo again.
Yes.
At this point, I want to tell that originally in the program, there was a talk by Karimi from Helsinki on quantum heat engines and a heat valve in a superconducting qubit, but unfortunately this talk is now cancelled because this application was rejected. But if you wish to discuss this topic, I'm here free to discuss it afterwards. So we continue by Rui Sampaio from Aalto University, Finland, and he will talk about impossible quantum distribution. This is a very neat talk.